Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour has written a piece in the winter issue of American Prospect titled Blustering Toward Armageddon, How Donald Trump Will Take America to War. He talks a great deal in the very interesting and alarming article about belligerent deterrence, which has been used before in this country by other leaders. But he says that Donald Trump is not interested in policy detail, expertise, or experience. He bases his personal power on the very kinds of blustering rhetoric and muscular posturing that have caused so many problems for American policy in the past. His attitude toward foreign policy is clear and consistent. He will act unilaterally using threats to intimidate allies and adversaries, will make deals with other tough guys, particularly Vladimir Putin. And as a result, and our guest outlines in this article, America facing the risk of war in not just one theater of conflict, but in four separate theaters of conflict. And we will talk about those this hour. Our guest, Jeremy Suri, is a professor in the Department of History and the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's written or edited 8 books on American politics and foreign policy, including The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, which will come out this spring. And his article is in the winter 2017 issue of The American Prospect. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Suri, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, our pleasure. Before we talk about the four possible theaters of war, let's look a little historically at this idea of belligerent deterrence. Is this something new on the American scene or not?
It's not new. Really, since the early 20th century, in different regions of the world, what the United States has done has been to try to deter adversaries by flexing muscle, showing our capabilities, and trying to intimidate their behavior. Now, that's not always a bad thing, but it has, I think, as a historical phenomenon, often produced more problems than we assume in advance. And the main reason it produces problems is that we assume adversaries will be cowed by our threatening rhetoric, but oftentimes it's just the opposite. It provokes. And I think that's the world we're entering into right now.
Do you feel that Donald Trump has given us any indication that he understands policy, that he understands foreign affairs, that he understands our historical relationship with countries all over the world, in the Mideast, in Russia, in North Korea, South Korea, China? Does he have a sense of what's going on and what has gone on?
Well, I think he has a disdain for people like myself who try to become experts on these issues or some of these issues and try to understand the intricacies and the historical development of, for example, the United States' relations with China or with the Middle East. He doesn't believe that matters. He believes that individual character, individual rhetoric, and individual threats and deal-making are the route to policy. And that's very different from how we have conducted policy, at least since the end of World War II.
Well, he says he's going to make deals with someone like Vladimir Putin, as you describe him, another tough guy. What do you think he means by that?
I think Donald Trump's experience has been as a real estate developer in a highly contentious city, New York City, where you have to buy people off legally, which is to say you have to give people something to make them give you what you want. And I think that's how he approaches and will approach his relationship with Vladimir Putin. Quite frankly, I think Donald Trump doesn't care about Eastern Europe. He doesn't care about many of the other regions near Russia that the United States has cared about. And so he will try to not necessarily give Putin a free hand in those areas, but remove some of the obstacles the United States has placed in the way of Russian expansion and aggression in return for Putin helping him, for example, with access to resources in the Middle East, access to, let's say, the Arctic and other areas where Trump sees an economic interest for the United States.
Mm-hmm. You write, the next few years, perhaps just the first year of the Trump presidency, will bring us to a dangerous new precipice in multiple parts of the world, and you outline four parts of the world. What is most troublesome to you?
Well, most troublesome as a whole is the way in which this mix of provocative rhetoric and lack of preparation opens us up to making commitments that we'll have trouble backing down from. We'll get cornered very quickly, and this has happened repeatedly. And I particularly worry about this in the Middle East. We are sending an ambassador to Israel who has been an advocate of Israeli warfare in the region against Iran and elsewhere. We have a leader of Israel who has been an advocate of that. And we could very quickly find ourselves at war with Iran because of Israeli action that we have supported and inadvertently pulled ourselves into that war. And I would predict that might happen within months, not even within years.
Mm. And let's listen just a little bit here and get your response to this. This is what Donald Trump was addressing a Tea Party Patriots protest rally, speaking out against the Iranian nuclear deal. Let's listen to what Donald Trump had to say, and then we'll talk about it.
I've been doing deals for a long time. I've been making lots of wonderful deals, great deals. That's what I do. Never, ever, ever in my life have I seen any transaction so incompetently negotiated as our deal with Iran. And I mean never. Now, Ted and everybody else have gone through all of the details, and we can talk about the 24 days, which is ridiculous. We can talk about the $150 billion, which, by the way, they get, even if the deal isn't approved, they get it just for going to the table. We can talk about the fact that we have four wonderful people over there, and frankly, they're never going to come back with this group. And I will say this, if I win the presidency, I guarantee you that those four prisoners are back in our country before I ever take office. I guarantee that.
If Donald Trump, at the start of his administration, does tear up the Iranian nuclear agreement, and he has expressed his disdain for that agreement, you believe that there's a possibility that Tehran would resume its nuclear weapons program and could become a nuclear power in a few months, and that could create substantial problems.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly what would happen. If we pull out of this deal, let's remember this is a multinational deal. There are many other countries involved in it. The Germans, the French, the Russians are not going to reinstate sanctions on Iran. And the Iranians are going to see us pulling out of that deal as a direct threat to their security. So they are going to do what we would do if we were in their circumstances, which is rush to develop a nuclear weapon. And that will trigger a response from Israel. And this very quickly becomes a shooting war.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about this idea, I haven't thought about this very much, nuclear proliferation going well beyond Iran, Saudi Arabia, maybe Egypt, maybe Syria. Have they expressed an interest in developing a nuclear arsenal? And if Iran did it, would they likely do it too?
So the Syrians actually had a nuclear program in the early 2000s that the Israelis took military action against with our approval. The Egyptians have talked about this before. The Saudis have as well. There's every reason to believe that once Iran develops a nuclear weapon, other countries in the neighborhood would, particularly Saudi Arabia. The Saudis and the Iranians are rivals in the region. Their relationship is near warfare already. They're on opposite sides in the Syrian civil war. They're on opposite sides on so many issues. They're opposite branches of Islam. So if you're Saudi Arabia, why would you not do that? And they certainly have the money to buy the capability. So it's hard to imagine a world where Iran develops a nuclear weapon and other countries don't.
Mm-hmm. You also remind us, though, and he has reminded us on many occasions, that we've spent a whole lot of money trying to bring some kind of stability to the Middle East. We had this Arab Spring. Things were hopeful for a while. And it's been a terrible mess ever since then. What have we done that's been good in the last 8 years under the Obama administration? And is it time, as many voted for Donald Trump, who will believe that he's going to do something different here that will lessen the threat of terrorism and the expansion of terrorism in the Middle East and beyond?
sure. So there are a number of very good things the Obama administration did, and there's some things it did that were not as successful. Some of the good things the Obama administration did is they did end the occupation of Iraq. And the American occupation of Iraq made things worse. It was bleeding us of treasure and our citizens, and we weren't getting a better outcome. And getting out of that conflict was a good thing, and it took courage on President Obama's part, and that's a good thing. And by the way, Donald Trump was someone who supported that conflict early on. Second, President Obama has reached out to the Arab world. The views of the United States in the Arab world were much more positive as a consequence of Obama. That's been reversed now to some extent. And then the deal with Iran, what Donald Trump said in that clip and what he said in many places and what other Republicans have said is in some ways nonsense. There are reasons to say we could have gotten a better deal, perhaps, but this is nowhere close to the worst deal ever. That's hyperbole that is obfuscating rather than clarifying. The Iran deal prevented Iran from developing a nuclear weapon for 10 years, and it did not give a penny of American taxpayer money to Iran. What we released was Iranian money that we had been holding since 1979, and we opened up trade with Iran, which actually will be to our benefit and Iran's benefit. If you are a worker for Boeing, Boeing is now selling aircraft there. We will have more influence in Iran, and we will have a positive influence on that region because of this deal. Could it have been a better deal? Maybe. But it's a real achievement that Obama got that through. Mm-hmm. So those are good things he did. There are many failures, too. I don't mean to paint a rosy picture. I think he has a mixed record in that region. But those good things are all in jeopardy, each one of them, because Donald Trump, it's not even that he's opposed to them. It's that he's run against them. He's made commitments. You heard it in that clip. And once you say you're going to do something when you're running, it's hard not to do it when you're in office.
Concerning the end of the occupation of Iraq, he has said repeatedly that we left way too early and it created ISIS.
Yeah, so things were getting better in Iraq in 2007, 2008, but Kathleen, that's only because they had gotten so bad in 2003, 2004, 2005. We were in a state of flux in 2007, 2008. We were able to protect our forces better. We were able to limit some of the terrorist activities. But unless we were going to make a much larger long-term commitment, which the American people were not going to make, we were otherwise simply going to be in a holding pattern that was going to be costly and breed more resentment toward the United States. What created ISIS was not Obama's pulling out. It was George W. Bush's going in the first place and undermining a regime that was a horrible regime, but a regime that was not supporting terrorist groups like ISIS. Many of the leaders of ISIS were in our prisons. This is something a number of us have written about. We're in our prisons in Iraq when George W. Bush was president. So blaming Barack Obama makes no sense.
What about Donald Trump's talk about working with Russia to defeat terrorists in Syria? This Syria thing has just been so horrible on so many fronts and for so long. We seem to have a hard time identifying forces within Syria who would be an acceptable alternative to Assad, anybody who's willing to fight, really. And I'm wondering what you think of Donald Trump's comments that he would work with Russia to defeat ISIS in Syria, what his thoughts are there, and why this is just a continual horror.
Yes. Well, so I think this is a failure of the Obama administration. So I think this is a fair criticism to some extent, not quite the way it's been made by the president-elect. But the Obama administration saw Syria coming apart and saw the Assad regime moving toward genocidal behavior. And Obama thought that by announcing a red line and talking tough, that would discourage Assad, and it didn't. And in fact, Russia has increased its support to Assad consistently and given him the ability to undertake genocidal behavior, and we've done nothing about it. And that will be part of Obama's negative legacy in the region. So in part, what Donald Trump is saying does make some sense. We're at a point now where we can't control or stop the genocide, and the Russians do have influence. So we do, to some extent, have to work through them. That's also been Secretary of State John Kerry's approach. What we have to be realistic about, though, is that the Russians are the problem as well as the solution. They have been supporting and encouraging Assad. And so if we're going to work with them, we have to do it in an open-eyed way. We shouldn't presume that they share our goals. They do not.
Mm-hmm. When you say, Professor Suri, that we could expect a large American ground presence, you say this in your article, again in the Middle East, and this by the second half of Trump's first term. What kind of presence? Where?
So I think if we pull out of the deal with Iran and the Iranians develop a nuclear capability and Israel goes to war with them, that will trigger a much broader war in the Middle East with other states fighting Israel. And we will be called in to act not as a defender of Israel per se, but as an occupier to separate and rebuild areas that will be destroyed. And our forces will be right back on the ground again in parts of Iran, in parts of Lebanon, parts of Syria. It'll be very hard for us not to go in after we've been fawning over Israel and condemning everything Iran does.
Our guest is Jeremy Suri. He's a professor in the Department of History and Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs, University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of the forthcoming The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office, coming out this spring. And the article that we are concentrating on this hour is in the winter issue of American Prospect. And we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. The article is titled, Blustering Toward Armageddon, How Donald Trump Will Take America to War. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to messages coming in and to phone calls, starting with Elaine in Colfax. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I just had a comment and then a question. I think using Twitter is extraordinarily dangerous and quite infantile, but I wondered if there's any world leaders that the guest knows of that use this medium to communicate to their population, and isn't it possible in the future that this could be a security risk because we won't even know if it's actually Trump tweeting? I mean, there's no way to prove that it's actually him on the other end.
Great questions, Elaine. And I agree that using Twitter is irresponsible, largely because it doesn't raise the discourse; it lowers our collective discourse. 140 word rants don't help us understand issues in any way, and it is childish. I don't know of any other world leaders who use Twitter. I imagine we'll see more of them now using Twitter. I think it's a security risk, as you said, because we don't know who's actually sending, but I also think Twitter's a dangerous way to conduct policy and communicate to people because 140 characters are much better at telling someone something to get them angry, not explaining to them how something really works. And that's what leaders are supposed to do, is explain and educate, not provoke.
Ed on Facebook writes, the challenge for the next 4 years for Trump and company will be to moderate their responses. He lacks discipline. Listening to him speak hurts since he rarely completes a statement, rambling off on a different tangent. Imagine him meeting with foreign leaders and how they will perceive him. How will they perceive him?
That's a good question. Well, we have reason to believe that many European leaders, including Angela Merkel, perceive him as an ignoramus and a very threatening figure. I think they look at him and see him as a right-wing demagogue, and countries like Germany have long experience with this, so they know what they're talking about. So I don't think they have a very positive view of him. I do think there are other leaders like Vladimir Putin, Erdogan, the leader of Turkey, and others who see themselves as strong men, as authoritarian figures, as figures bringing order and wisdom to their populations, and they see a kindred spirit in Trump. It's an interesting historical phenomenon, Kathleen, that dictators, even dictators from very different societies and very different cultures, historically often see a lot in common with one another, just as Democrats do. And so I think the leaders who style themselves as strongmen around the world will be very comfortable with Donald Trump, and he'll be comfortable with them.
You're right. He clearly feels more comfortable dealing with Putin than with America's democratic allies in Europe. And this is another theater of possible war that you mention in your article. He doesn't seem to have much love for NATO. There could be a possibility that we would leave NATO altogether. And then the possible, we don't know what Putin's up to. We don't know. You know, he's moved nuclear weapons to places where people feel threatened. He may consider an incursion into a Baltic country, not out of the range of possibility. And then what?
Right. Well, I think that's exactly the problem with not thinking deeply and trying to understand the historical evolution of various issues. NATO is the most successful alliance in the history of the world. That doesn't mean it's perfect. It doesn't even mean it should go on forever. But it's done some very important things. It has provided a shield for European democratic development, and that's a great achievement. And if you pull that away, you make very big risks, and you send a message to Vladimir Putin that he has a free hand in some areas, which he claims to be in Russia's sphere, to do things that even Trump might not accept. And that's where this gets really dangerous, because Putin might go farther than Trump expects he will, and then Trump will feel backed into a military response. And I foresee that happening.
You really do? You think that could happen?
I think Vladimir Putin will look at Trump and think that Trump might not even last 4 years, and that he should get what he can.
Mm-hmm.
And he will. There's a long history of this. He will underestimate Trump in a certain way, and presume that Trump is all talk, no action. That he can charm Trump and also intimidate him at the same time, and he'll try to do that, and move his forces into the Baltics or somewhere like that, or further into Ukraine. And Trump will then feel insulted. He'll feel his ego's on the line, and he'll feel pressured by his own party, by people like John McCain, to respond, and we'll find ourselves at war.
What about his talk about lessening sanctions if there could be a reduction in arms? Do you think that Donald Trump is very interested in reduction of nuclear arms? Is that a possibility?
I see no evidence of that. In fact, I see evidence of him believing that more nuclear weapons are better. It's a way of showing strength. It's a way of widening the gap between us and other societies. And the beauty of nuclear weapons for someone like Trump is that you're able to show power without having to go to war. So I don't see him as a great arms control negotiator. I do think he'll reduce economic sanctions on Russia because he believes more trade, even though he's against losing jobs, but he believes that more open trade between the U.S. and Russia will actually increase wealth for the people he cares about in both societies.
Hmm. We had a Russian expert on from UW-Madison a couple days ago trying to figure out this, and I'm sure a lot of people are trying to figure this out, the Russian-Trump connection here, what's going on with all of this. He knew what he was talking about and said that he thought it would be 20 to 30 years before we could understand that dossier and find out what's true and what's not true. What are your thoughts about this Russian connection and what we know and what we might know and when we'll know it?
So I do think it'll take a long time until those of us as historians are able to actually get a full account of the dossier and really, you know, understand. We're still just figuring out really what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. So
right, right.
I think so it does take a long time. There are a few things that we do know. There are some facts that are obvious and indisputable. Vladimir Putin has been conducting in West European countries and in the United States, and it comes directly from him, a propaganda effort and a direct effort at interfering with democratic processes because he views democratic processes as dangerous to his own society. Two, we also know as a fact that he wanted to do everything he could to harm Hillary Clinton. He assumed she would be elected president, but he wanted to harm her because she, he thought, had harmed him in 2011. So we know those things, and we do know that material by Russian hackers who were connected to him was stolen from Democratic National Committee servers and elsewhere and selectively leaked. And we know also they took information on Donald Trump that they have. All of that is known. How it affected voters, that's the debatable proposition. The details of how they stole things is to some extent still classified, but we do know that they were interfering with our election. And the unwillingness of Donald Trump and others to recognize that and acknowledge that and respond to that is a real problem.
800-486-8655 is our number, and we have lines open if you would like to join this conversation. Nancy in Madison, hi.
Well, I think this comes right into the question that I wanted to ask, which is, do we consider Russia to be an enemy of ours? They're an adversary for certain. But if that's the case, I would consider that Trump is actually giving aid and comfort to our enemy, which is an impeachable offense. If you pay attention to the Constitution, it's the second requirement.
I think Nancy has a point. I think if you are interfering with our election, if you are intentionally trying to shape the outcome of our election from abroad, that is an act of near war against the United States. And anyone who abets and aids that process is committing treason. The real question that my friends in the world of intelligence are asking themselves is not whether this happened, but whether Trump knew about it or not. Was he an unknowing actor or a knowing actor? And that's what we're going to find out in the next few months, because that is actually what the intelligence agencies are looking very, very closely at. What did he know? Did Bannon and others who were close to him have direct communications with the Russians or not? If they did, if there's a direct link between Trump and Putin on this issue, then it is definitely a criminal treason that is prosecutable in an American court.
And who's looking at this? The FBI is carrying on with an investigation.
Yes.
Senate Intelligence Committee. When are they starting up?
I think they start up next week, if I'm not mistaken.
Do they?
But I think they're already, you know, they already have their own investigators who are looking at this. The FBI is looking into this. The CIA is looking into this. The NSA is looking into this. They're looking at, you know, telephonic communication and other things. So all the intelligence agencies are looking at this because it's their job, but quite frankly, also because he's attacked them.
Mm-hmm.
And which is a really interesting phenomenon that he's gone after these agencies, which in a sense imperils him because they have information on him too.
Mm-hmm. The Israelis are looking into this. The Brits are looking into this. Yeah. There are probably other countries looking into this.
And I do think we'll find evidence of a direct, you know, Putin to Trump communication about this. We're going to find that people very, very close to Trump, perhaps even in his family, had direct communication with Russian actors who were known to be responsible for the cyber incursions. And we're going to see some prosecutions. Whether Trump directly gets caught up in this or not, I don't know.
And does it become a big deal or not? We already suspect there doesn't seem to be a huge uproar among the Republican members of Congress, and nor a huge uproar among the American public about this. It's kind of strange.
Well, I think, yes, I think there hasn't been a huge uproar about it, in part because there's such distrust of all kinds of elites. But also, I think a lot of people are still shell-shocked from the election itself. So processing all of this, we're sort of overloaded with scandals and accusations and everything else. But I do think, Kathleen, as we get into a Trump presidency and we go 4, 5, 6 months in and we see more and more aggression by Vladimir Putin, more and more setbacks for the United States around the world, people will start to think more about this and care more about this. Right now it's abstract. I mean, it might have affected who was elected, but it doesn't affect – we're not talking about it affecting policy yet, but we'll see those effects soon.
Nancy, thanks for your call. 800-486-8655. Matt in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Two comments, if I could. One, how do we know, since we're not being told, that the Russians were directly involved when the only leaks came from WikiLeaks, and Julian Assange has said that there are no connections to the Russians? And two, how much of this is political, because Bradley Manning knowingly stole intelligence secrets and gave them to foreign countries, was put in jail, and President Obama just pardoned him? And during President Obama's term, he gave $350,000 to a pro-Palestinian independence movement called One Voice that used the money to try to oust Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. So aren't we being hypocritical when we're directly involving ourselves in other countries' democratic elections?
These are great points you raise, Matt, and I'll try to address them. But I think these are serious points. These are the kinds of points we need to discuss. So in terms of Russian involvement, the report that was released by all the intelligence agencies together, not by one or another, by the FBI, the same FBI that went after Hillary Clinton, by the NSA and by the CIA, the report that James Clapper and Comey and Brennan briefed Trump on a couple of weeks ago. The released version, which you can get on the web, lays out very clearly how many of those who were involved in the leaking of the information about Hillary Clinton worked directly for the Kremlin, RT Television, for example, and others, and how they were leaking material that they only were able to get through some means that was not traditional means, that they had to have gained access to that information. So there is pretty clear evidence that they were involved with this, and the report also shows evidence that WikiLeaks was getting this information from the Russians. What the report does not show is the raw intelligence, but what they briefed Trump on and Obama on were actual intercepted phone calls and other things that not only showed connections between entities on paper, but direct communication between WikiLeaks entities and Russian entities. What we don't have direct evidence of yet is Putin's fingerprints on this. And if you look carefully at how Putin responded, he simply said that he was not involved. He didn't deny that Russian entities were involved. But we do know the Russian entities that were involved have received a tremendous amount of financing from him, and some are actually owned by his close friends. So it's pretty close. There's a pretty clear preponderance of evidence. Most people, even those who are supporters of Trump who have looked at this, I think would have trouble denying that there's a very, very close link there. Now, the Chelsea Manning story is an important one. Chelsea Manning, the main reason Chelsea Manning was put in prison was for releasing photos of the torture committed by American soldiers at Abu Ghraib. That was a prisonable offense because it was a felony to release secret information in that way. But there's no evidence that Chelsea Manning gave any secrets to the Russians or others. Edward Snowden did that, not Chelsea Manning. And Chelsea Manning has served 7 years in prison. Obama was not allowing her to get off without punishment. She served 7 years in prison, which is not unreasonable for what she did. And I would also say that her releasing information about the torture at Abu Ghraib helped our country because it helped us to actually stop doing that, which was a good thing. Your final point is absolutely dead on, right? We are hypocritical. We have been involved in doing the very things we're criticizing the Russians of doing in other people's elections. And I'm one of many people who have argued that we shouldn't do that ourselves, that we've been wrong to do that. The Church Committee in the 1970s and Congress prohibited much of that activity. Democrats and Republicans time and again have said we shouldn't do this. And so I'm not criticizing the Russians for interfering in our election and saying it's okay for us to interfere in others. I'm saying sovereign states should not interfere in other sovereign states' elections, and I would want to apply that to us as much as applying that to the Russians.
And going back to information that the intelligence agencies had, I've always wondered here, the classified information that was given to Congress that led John Lewis to say that he didn't believe that Donald Trump was a legitimate president and would boycott the election, the inauguration, as many others have followed suit. What was in that classified briefing? Do you know?
I don't know any details, but what I do know is there is direct raw intelligence of direct communication between Russian, Kremlin-linked Russian entities and WikiLeaks, and strategizing between them about how to hurt Hillary Clinton. I don't know if there's anything in there about how this affected votes. That's the part we don't know. It's possible all this happened and it didn't affect votes. It's possible that it did affect votes. And I don't know if there's raw intelligence on whether Donald Trump knew. The published report indicates that there's raw intelligence that shows the kind of direct link. And the only reason that's not being released yet, and I think they should release it, the reason it's not being released is we don't want everyone to know exactly how we acquire this information. Some of it, I'm told, it was acquired through the British, actually.
We have yet to move on to North Korea. The Bush and the Obama administration, our guest writes, relying on a multilateral diplomatic framework, including South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia, to contain North Korea and their belligerence. What does Donald Trump plan to do about that threat? And we'll also look at the South China Sea, and we'll welcome more of your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Matt, thanks for your call. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Before we go back to phone calls and our guest, this is Donald Trump answering CNN anchor Wolf Blitzer's question regarding whether we need to rethink NATO.
Yes, because it's costing us too much money. And frankly, they have to put up more money. They're going to have to put some up also. We're paying disproportionately. It's too much. And frankly, it's a different world than it was when we originally conceived of the idea and everybody got together. But we're taking care of, as an example, the Ukraine. I mean, the countries over there don't seem to be so interested, and we're the ones taking the brunt of it. So I think we have to reconsider, keep NATO, but maybe we have to pay a lot less toward the NATO itself.
So we continue our conversation now. Jeremy Suri is our guest this hour of the program, professor in the Department of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, wrote a piece, Blustering Toward Armageddon, How Donald Trump Will Take America to War. It appears in the American Prospect, the winter issue. Before we go back to phone calls, and we'll get to them, I promise you, in just one moment, I wanted to move to North Korea here and get a little more background. The Bush and Obama administration, you talk about they're relying on a multilateral diplomatic framework, what that means, and whether or not Donald Trump is to follow suit.
Yes. So North Korea is one of the most difficult issues, and neither George W. Bush nor Barack Obama came up really with a good policy to deal with this problem. We have a regime in North Korea that is beyond horrible, right? It's a regime that starves its own people. It's a regime that basically rules to promote the Kim family, and it has developed a nuclear capability. This has occurred over the last decade and a half, and now a delivery capability with missile technology. What the both Bush and Obama administrations have done is to work closely with their allies and other countries around North Korea. This includes South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia, to contain the North Korean regime with the hope that eventually the regime will reform itself or collapse. This involves a lot of delicate diplomacy because the Chinese in particular do not want to see the North Koreans start a war, but they also don't want to see the United States enter North Korea if the North Korean regime falls. The South Koreans don't want to see a war, but they don't want a huge refugee crisis. So it's a very delicate area, and the United States cannot solve this problem alone. We need to work closely with all of these allies, but when you're bad-mouthing these allies, it's very hard to do that.
The South China Sea. We don't pay much attention to that area at all.
And we have a similar issue there. I mean, the South China Sea is a region where you have waters claimed, in some cases, by four or five different countries, most of whom are allies of the United States. So there are conflicts among those countries, Vietnam, Indonesia, Philippines. And then there's, of course, conflict with China, which claims a lot of this area. Again, it's not a problem we can solve alone. We've done a better job there, I think, of managing things, but perhaps the Obama administration was not forceful enough. Going forward, we're going to need to work with our allies very closely, and we're going to have to negotiate with the Chinese. And at the very least, Kathleen, one has to be willing to recognize that these issues are incredibly complex and require a lot of close study. If you don't study them closely, you're not in a position to even pass judgment.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that he has people surrounding him? So many presidents have said, our most recent president, just in the last couple of days, who you surround yourself with is very, very important. You can't, and no one person can do this job alone. It's just way too big. Are you confident that Donald Trump has some really good minds around him?
So I expected, Kathleen, that after the election, Donald Trump, as a good businessman, would surround himself, as you said, with good minds and would reach out. He would reach out to the best minds, Democrats, Republicans, independents, all kinds of people who could bring important knowledge here, and that he would also try to draw on the existing knowledge in the administration. That's precisely what Obama did when replacing George W. Bush, and that transition was a very effective transition for both administrations. Donald Trump has not done that. He has surrounded himself in his cabinet picks and other close picks by people who know almost nothing about the issues. And individuals who have strong opinions without much foundation. And that's really dangerous. There is no one, Kathleen, no one I know who thinks highly of Michael Flynn on security issues. The man was fired from his job at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he is now Donald Trump's national security advisor. Many people think highly of Rex Tillerson, who's been nominated to be Secretary of State. But Rex Tillerson, in his own words at his confirmation hearing, indicated he doesn't know much about these issues, and he's not even talked to Donald Trump about them. So there's no other alternative but to say, no, Donald Trump has not surrounded himself with knowledgeable people or people who are prepared to deal with these issues.
Chuck in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you, Chuck?
Oh, not bad.
Good. Go right ahead.
I wasn't a Donald Trump supporter. I was a Democrat. And I think that, I'm a simple man. I listen to all the news and on TV, and, I think that WikiLeaks is just, it's a farce. It's you know, another way of going after the Democrats, and then you know, not providing. I just think the whole political system is just kind of in an uproar.
And tell me, Chuck, are you worried that Donald Trump may take us to war?
Pardon me?
Are you worried that Donald Trump may take us to war?
It could be. It's possible. You know, he's, you know, he hasn't even gotten sworn in yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess we have to wait and see what he's going to do. There's, you know, hopefully he'll go with his advisors on what they're advising to do.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as him going to war, I guess being a citizen, I would, you know, I was in the Marine Corps for 15 years, so, you know, I know all about, you know,
going to war, right?
Following what, you know, what the commander tells us to do. You know, if we go in the war, then we, you know, we do. We, you know, we don't have any choice in the matter. He's the one that's, it's mm-hmm. his ultimate decision, not ours.
Yeah, thank you, Chuck, very much for the call. Well, I guess we do have to wait and see, don't we?
Well, of course we do, and I've been saying this since I published this article. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope he proves me wrong. I really do. But what we also have to do is judge his behavior since he's been elected president. Nothing I say is about the election. It's what we're seeing since the election, and it's all reinforced these points about erratic, uninformed behavior. He has picked now a team. He's nominated a team. We can judge him. I think it's fair to judge him on that. We can judge him on his statements like the one you played of his discussion with Wolf Blitzer. Our tradition as a country is once elected in this period of transition, this is a period we begin to judge and assess someone. And I will say, just as a matter of fact, foreign countries are doing this themselves. I know this. You can go and walk around Washington or talk to people. This is what they're doing. Every ambassador in the U.S. is not writing about Obama. Now they're writing about Trump and trying to assess him. So we're in the appropriate moment to assess him, and there's still time to be surprised. And one of the reasons I wrote the article is hoping to jolt some people around Trump into perhaps thinking through these issues a little more. So we can hope to be surprised. What I do know for certain, by the way, Chuck, is that the Packers are going to beat the Falcons this Sunday. Go Packers.
Chuck will be happy to hear that in Green Bay, I'm sure. Thanks, Chuck, very much for the call. And I think that you've achieved your stated purpose to jolt a few people by the article, because indeed it does that. Karen in Winona, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi. Oh, Kathleen, thank you so much for this program. You gave us information about the WMDs. You give us information about all kinds of important things. And then when we get too discouraged, you have a program about dogs. So thank you. I want to thank the professor also, and I do have a question. I want to first say my husband and I have been politically active for a long, long time. We first worked in George McGovern's campaign.
Wow.
And during the Vietnam War, we lived in Korea. My husband was in the Air Force for 4 years. He was a nuclear weapons officer.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched two news programs. We watch the PBS Evening News always, and then we watch Rachel Maddow, and then Kathleen, we listen to your program, and we feel like we get trustworthy information from those sources. We are active in voting. I knock on doors for elections to get out the vote. We are both so discouraged. Last night, my husband said, Karen, what are we going to do? We feel like we want to be active. We notify our senators, who are good senators, and our representative to Congress, who also listens. But we aren't easily discouraged, and we aren't easily frightened. But this seems like a very serious time in our country, and I am looking for advice.
Thank you for the call. Professor?
Well, Karen, you're one of many people to be asking me this, and I'm sure many others are asking as well. I was actually just at an event last night here in Austin, Texas, where many people were saying exactly what you said. And I think there is a lot of cause for concern, but there's also then some inspiration in that. I think more than ever, certainly in my lifetime, it is important that people get involved and get their voices heard. This is a time to speak out, not to shut up. This is a point to go out and organize. This is a time to get involved. The real story of this election was not the story of who voted for Donald Trump and who voted for Hillary Clinton, but all those people who didn't vote. And particularly, I have to say, as a professor, I see lots and lots of young people who are not involved in the process. This is going to be their country. We need to educate them. We need to inspire them. We need to help and support their getting involved. And there's so much we can do. You know this as an activist, Karen. There's so much we can do at the local level. There's so much we can do in our own institutions to make things better and to be inspired from this horrible moment we're in to see that politics really do matter, that it makes a difference who gets out. It makes a difference who we put in office. For too long, Karen, we've been sending people into political office who are not the right people, and the best qualified people have been sitting on the sidelines. It's time for them to get involved. If we care about our country, you serve your country by getting involved in the political sphere. You've done that, and I hope you'll inspire other people, particularly young people, to do that. And I hope and pray that we'll be a better country because of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen, for your call. Gary in Duluth. Hi.
Afternoon.
Afternoon, Gary.
One of the necessities of fixing a problem is identifying it correctly.
Yes.
Donald Trump makes a lot of sense if you identify him, first of all, as an addictive personality. The main component in an addictive triangle is the victim. The victim always denies their issues, and once they've denied all of their issues, they are free to blame everybody else for all the problems. One of the primary traits of an addictive personality is they take everything personally.
Well, I think there's a lot in that. I'm always careful, Gary, to offer that kind of analysis only because it's not something I'm trained or an expert in. I'm not a psychologist. I've taken a few psychology classes, read a few books. But my rule is I shouldn't pontificate on things that I don't know anything about. What you're saying rings true to me. That's all I can say just because it's just not an area of training or expertise that I have.
Thanks, Gary, for the call. Michael writes on Facebook, blah, 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 same people who thought Hillary would win the election. Obama has been at war for his entire 8 years as president, and goes on to say, so tell me this, if these things that you are predicting don't come to pass in the next 4 years, will you come back and admit that you were wrong?
Yes. Thank you, Michael. I'm all for people admitting when they're wrong. I tell my students and when I lecture to others all the time that you only learn by making predictions and then being wrong and recognizing you were wrong and why. I was also wrong, as you say, Michael, about Hillary winning. I did think she was going to win the election. I thought she was a flawed candidate, but I thought she was going to win the election, and I thought she was going to be a decent president. I was obviously wrong on her winning the election. I've spent a lot of time soul-searching, admitting, and writing about why I was wrong and all the other experts were wrong. So I don't claim any kind of clairvoyance or prescience or perfection. I simply believe that we as a society need to talk through these issues and understand these issues. And simply saying blah, blah, blah when you hear what you don't like, that's not productive.
I wonder why it is that we have elected somebody, and this is not, you know, passing judgment on him, but we have elected somebody who doesn't seem to be a really strong reader, who doesn't have much of a sense of heroes in the world or of U.S. American history or world history. It seems to me, and maybe I'm just old-fashioned, I really would like the presidency to be occupied by somebody who is incredibly well-informed, be they conservative or liberal or wherever they're going to be, but really has looked at what's happened previously in this country and who's led this country for some kind of guidance. Do you see any of that?
Well, that's traditionally what we've chosen in a president, and
it is.
The recent book I've written is about that. I mean, that's what the founding fathers expected.
Good. You'll come back and talk to us about your book.
I'll be delighted.
Thank you.
Of course.
Okay.
Good. You know, that's what the founding fathers expected. That's what we've generally elected. I mean, the model is someone like Dwight Eisenhower or Ronald Reagan, for that matter. You know, Ronald Reagan was not necessarily a scholar. But he was a reader. He was a thinker. He had positions. He wrote his own speeches, and he always talked about American history. All of his campaign advertisements were all about the world he grew up in the United States and how he wanted to go back to that and bring elements of that together. It was a positive, hopeful, historical vision, and you could respect Reagan even if you didn't like his policies and vice versa.
Yeah, and on that note, we have to say goodbye because we're out of time. I asked too big a question, but you'll be back, and I thank you for being here now.
My pleasure.
Thanks,
Thank
Jeremy.
You, Kathleen. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Professor Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History at University of Texas at Austin, and his piece, you may want to read it. It is provocative, Blustering Toward Armageddon in the winter issue of American Prospect. It's on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show.